Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are so lucky to have with us this morning in the studio Simone Missick, who is making her Bay Area debut at Theater Works in Silicon Valley in the role of Cab May, which is one of the principal roles in the play The Mountaintop, which is closing this Sunday, April 7th. Simone Missick most recently appeared in the Los Angeles premiere of In the Red and Brown Water as Shun at the Fountain Theater. She has written and produced several one-act plays, including Love and War, which was featured in the show Looking for Trouble. She has appeared in various television and film productions as well, including the short film, Look Again, which won the Best Diaspora Film in the Kenyan Film Festival Awards and was nominated for the 2012 African Movie Award, which he mentioned is like the Oscars. Born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, she is a classically trained violinist with a BA in English and theater minor from Howard University. Ms. Missick credits God, friends, and family, and her number one fan, her amazing husband, for their support. So we are going to play this interview that we had with her just yesterday about her role as Kame in Katori Hall's The Mountaintop.
Yeah, so I just want to tell you that I was there at opening night, and I saw all the folks, you know, I think it was your husband brought you this big bouquet of flowers, and you know, you just were fantastic in your role as Kame.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I think my very favorite scene is when she puts on Martin King's jacket and stands on the bed and tells him how she would have approached.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, the conversation, and gave her great speech.
Right. It's a great moment in the play, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but your character is just so nuanced. Oh my goodness, and so full of surprises that we do not even anticipate.
Yeah, the playwright Katori Hall did a great job, I think, of writing a character for Black women to play that we don't often get to play, that goes through a lot emotionally as well as physically, that you don't often see with Black female characters. And she said that she wrote it because there was a dearth of characters for her to study when she was in acting school. And so she wrote this play and this character specifically, I think, to address that issue. And, you know, we have some amazing playwrights, but that within the African American canon of theater, but you don't often see female characters written as fully realized and as nuanced, as you said. And so it's a great role to play because it definitely is a lot of fun, and it's written within the fabric of who Black people are, so it's comfortable, and yet still it takes, the character goes places that you don't really expect her to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's just so great, you know, that you are, you know, sort of breathing life into Kame, because, you know, you're not just an actress, you're also a playwright yourself.
I am. Yeah, I've had the fortune of writing some one-act plays that have gotten produced by a theater company in Los Angeles with a former teacher of mine named Carrie Keene, and she started a theater company called the White Buffalo Theater Company and asked me to perform several of my pieces with them at different points, and then I've had other people ask me to perform it during different productions that they wanted to do. But I've written two one-acts that both deal with the different issues within the Black community. One is a couple that have a child together, but they're no longer in a relationship anymore, and just the problems that they have in communicating with one another. And then another piece that I wrote deals with the African American woman and her struggles with thinking about interracial dating. Mm-hmm. And both pieces are are dramedy. They're mainly comedic, but then they also deal with just, you know, real issues that we do have within our community. But they both break the fourth wall and speak directly to the audience, and these characters mirror what each other are thinking in both pieces, but don't necessarily say out loud. So the audience is like a third character in the pieces, and they get to really have an insight almost, if they're a fly on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Right. Sounds like, you know, as a writer, you know, Kame is, you know, the type of character that you're very familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really say that. I think Kame is very different from anyone I've necessarily met, and that was one of the challenges with this play. You know, we all know people who are sassy, and we all know people who are outspoken, and you know, have a lot of life force within them.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the issues that she went through during the 60s and during the time that she grew up, during the time that this play is set, mm-hmm. are very different from anything I, as a young woman growing up in Detroit, a predominantly black city in the 80s and 90s, ever had to deal with. And even my parents mm-hmm. and my family, when I was researching this character, my dad grew up in D.C., my mom grew up in Detroit, but neither one of them really went through some of the things that people who grew up in the Deep South had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
They had the opportunity to avoid certain places, and, you know, they lived in neighborhoods where they knew where to go and where not to go, whereas, you know, I think people like Kame, who grew up in the Deep South in Memphis, it was not just, oh, you stick to your own. You could be subject to racism and violence anywhere in the city of Memphis during that time. So Kame it was not a character that I readily identify with, which made the research that much richer, because it was like starting from a completely blank slate.
Is that fun?
Absolutely. You know, I think for Adrian Roberts, who plays Martin Luther King, his journey was a little bit different because we have so much information on Martin Luther King. And so as an actor, you know, there's a certain part of him who has to honor who this man was, but then he also gets to infuse his own artistic ideas into the play. Whereas for me, it was literally starting with a blank slate, and the only thing that you have is the writing. And so that informs you of a lot, but you have the freedom and the creativity to pretty much do and bring whatever you want to it. And my director, Anthony Haney, was so awesome in that way that he just let me play. I literally felt like a kid
mm-hmm.
playing every single day that we had rehearsal. And, you know, there are some very serious things that we deal with, but as an actor, just the ability to say, I'm going to do whatever comes out, and that's a safe space to have and to do. It was definitely so much fun. So, mm-hmm. so much fun. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, when I was reading some of the background on casting, and I saw Adrian Roberts in Hamlet at California Shakespeare Theater
when
he played
yeah.
Claudius and the Ghost, and it's like, oh, that was him.
Yeah, yeah.
And I saw him in Ruined as well. He was great in that.
He's an amazing actor.
Yeah. And so I was reading that people didn't necessarily want to play Martin Luther King Jr. because they felt, ooh, you know, I don't want to, you know, be the one remembered as you know, the person who portrayed this man. And because, you know, the whole situation, I mean, he's, you know, we know historically that he wasn't feeling really well the day before you know, the sanitation workers' strike, and he had thought about not speaking at the church, mm-hmm. but then he thought about the people who were expecting him, and of course, you know, he didn't want to disappoint them, so he went and gave that, you know, really wonderful speech, you know, mm-hmm. where he talks about going to the mountaintop. Mm-hmm. And so he comes back, and he's relaxing and at the Lorraine Motel, you know, and this you know, young woman comes with his coffee, and this is her first day on the job or night on the job, and who, you know, who should she have but a celebrity client, you know, a celebrity
right.
guest.
Right.
And who smokes the same kind of cigarette she smokes, Paul
yeah.
Malls, and just the whole interaction between, you know, your character and Adrian Roberts, Martin Luther King Jr. character, it's just, yeah, we don't know what's going to happen. Like, are they going to, sort of, where is this conversation going to go? Are they going to, because people have, there are a lot of stories that float around about Martin King and him having, being, you know, having relationships outside of his marriage. And so
mm-hmm.
we don't quite, I mean, I didn't know as I was sitting there wondering, like, where is this going to go?
Yeah, and I think that's the beauty of the play. I
mm-hmm.
think the playwright, Katori Hall, definitely said she has no problem putting our leaders on display and,
mm-hmm.
and playing with our perspective and our ideas of who these people are. And I think a lot of people do find it difficult, and I'm sure a lot of actors were concerned or afraid of approaching this character because it does not portray Martin Luther King as this godly, as a saint.
Mm-hmm.
She does not portray Martin Luther King as a perfect man, as a man without flaws or faults or doubts or fears. She portrays him as a man, as a three-dimensional character. And I think a lot of times we as people, but oftentimes us in the African-American community, we don't like our leaders to be, their faults to be put on display. And I understand the side of it,
mm-hmm.
which is that, you know, we don't have a media that shows all sides of black people. We don't have a country that really celebrates all the different facets of us, that we can be intelligent, but then also we can have people who are, we can have the full spectrum and array of personality traits and faults and flaws as white people have. We don't necessarily have that ability. So when we have a leader or someone that we honor and we look up to, we very much hold that person dear, and we don't want anything to mar that image of them
mm-hmm.
because, you know, we don't want for children to say, oh, Martin Luther King was a great man, but he cheated on his wife, or he was afraid of where the movement was taking him, or he wasn't 100% certain. We don't like anything to be said about our leaders. And so it is difficult for us to be honest sometimes and to recognize that people have faults no matter who they are. We're all human beings. And I think that that's a great choice of the playwright, and it's a great message that this play has, which is that, yes, Martin Luther King was an amazing man. He changed the country and this world in the span of 13 years. At 25 years old,
mm-hmm.
he undertook a tremendous task that no one else wanted, and he took the civil rights movement to a place that no one else thought it could possibly go. And he made more of an impact in his life and after his death than any other American, I think, in the history of this country. But he also was just a man
mm-hmm.
with faults and flaws. And I think it's hard for us to look at that because sometimes if we can say, well, that person was perfect, then we don't have to put the task back on ourselves to pick up the torch or to pass on the baton or to look out for our fellow man or
mm-hmm.
to help out other people because we think, well, I'm not perfect. I can't possibly do that. But I think that was the message of the play, which is that we all are like Martin Luther King. We all have the ability to to help one another and to pick up the baton, because nobody's perfect and mm-hmm. we don't have to be.
Right, right. And I think, you know, one thinks about grace and one thinks about divinity. This play, certainly with, you know, your character Kameh and Adrian Roberts, Martin Luther King Jr., shows that flaws don't detract from one's greatness.
Mm-hmm.
No one said that a great person has to be perfect or flawless, because that's not how we come anyway as human
right.
beings into this particular environment,
right.
you know, to work through whatever we have to work through to get to the next level.
Right.
Yeah, what I really, really like about your Kameh is just how true she is to who she is. I mean, you know, she...
Mm-hmm.
She's all of herself.
Yeah.
Granted, she is in awe of this great man, you know, who wouldn't be? But she's also honest. And,
yeah.
and I like the way that Martin King listens to her. And because she's got, she has a lot, she says a lot of things that are very wise considering she's a really young woman.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, oftentimes we look at people and we judge them.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, oh, this person is young, or they're maybe uneducated, or, you know, sometimes people from the North judge people from the South and think that because they have a Southern accent, they're not as intelligent. Or, you know, we all have our own prejudices about people, but Kameh definitely does dispel all of those misconceptions that people had about not just Black people or Southerners, but women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, during that time, during the Civil Rights Movement, there weren't a very many female leaders, especially within the Martin Luther King camp, the SCLC.
Mm-hmm.
Women, because it was a Southern Christian Leadership Conference, they did not, they weren't at that time ready for women to be leaders. And it was understandable because that was the tradition within the country. And so Kameh and these ideas that she has and these thoughts that she shares with King are so revolutionary, because it's almost like out of the mouths of babes, you know, out of the mouth of this seemingly simple woman. You know, she's a maid in a hotel. She says all of these things that are revolutionary
mm-hmm.
at the time. And he does listen to her. And I think that Dr. King at that time, you know, was really going to start looking at the women's movement as well. He recognized that women deserved as equal rights as much as men did. And I think that had he lived longer, that would have probably been one of the next issues that he would have addressed, in addition to the civil rights movement. But unfortunately, we'll never know. But as a result of him and his life, it definitely did open up the doors. The civil rights movement did open up the women's liberation movement, and just seeing women organize and fight in our country for equal treatment and equal pay and equal rights. And I think it had a lot to do with the civil rights movement and the work of Dr. King.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly, certainly. I saw... Mountaintop when it was in its really embryonic stage, when it was a part of the Bay Area Playwrights Festival, and
wow.
over at the Magic Theater in Fort Mason Center. And C. Kelly
wow.
Wright had your character, Kameh, and to see, it's just so wonderful just to see over, I don't know, God, it feels like over 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, I don't know, it's been a long time. I remember, you know, the germ of the idea, however, it's just, oh my goodness, as the full-blown production, it is just so phenomenal. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about maybe some of your favorite scenes, particularly when Kameh is dispelling these myths, and Martin King has like, it's like, okay, well, and, you know, like sort of like rethink
right.
what he was thinking. And then also on the same note, I just love the whole notion of the Black woman as God. I just think that's like, oh my God, that's so wonderful. Like, ah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. to answer your first question,
mm-hmm.
some of my favorite I guess if you would say scenes, even though the play is one act.
Right. What's the technical term for it? I don't know what to call it.
I would just say moments.
Moments.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't even know if there's a technical term for it, but
okay.
gosh, it's so difficult. I think there is a moment where Kame and Dr. King are going head to head. There are two moments, and one is, you know, when she's talking to him about Malcolm X, because you know, in the way that Martin Luther King is portrayed in this particular play, he has certain judgments of a lot of things, but also of Malcolm X, and you know, he reveals that he believes that he was a violent man. And that, you know, his violence was his own undoing. And, you know, Kame just calls to question Dr. King's own faults and challenges him to think about the fact that we are all flawed. And she says, we all have faults. And she's sure that he has his own. And that's, you know, a really fun moment in the play, because it's the play itself is just one big push and pull, a power struggle between the two of them. And, you know, a lot of people, when they see the play, they don't know what to expect. They see this woman come in, they wonder, are they going to sleep together? Is this going to be, you know, a whole play about Martin Luther King trying to get into this maid's pants? And they don't know what it's going to be about. And there is a certain level of unevenness between the two of them. And he definitely, you know, has a presence that is unnerving to her, because she is just a regular woman who is meeting the most famous man in America, not just black man, but man.
Mm-hmm.
But then as the play progresses, you see that this is really just a battle of wits between these two people that you would never think would be in a room together and speaking, and let alone arguing the state of America and the civil rights movement together. And yet you are able to see some of the things that Dr. King had to contend with. You know, he did have people within his own movement that didn't 100% agree with his tactics. Everybody didn't want to be nonviolent, but he very much stood by that as the only way that the movement would work. And as the civil rights movement progressed over the time, people did begin to be frustrated with that. You know, they felt like this peaceful, nonviolent stance was not going to be what would change the minds of their oppressors. And so through Kame and King's struggle back and forth, you get to see what common people who weren't a part of King's movement really felt about the state of affairs in America. And it's a great, so I think that scene is probably one of my favorite scenes.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of addressing that God is a black woman, not just a woman, but a black woman.
Yes.
I mean, as a black woman myself,
mm-hmm.
and as a Christian, you know, I've been taught that God is a man, but God is a spirit. God isn't a man or a woman. God is spirit, and that we were created in God's image. And so I think that religion puts a very tight definition on what that is. You know, I think now that the series, The Bible, has come out, a lot of people have been arguing, well, why is Jesus Christ still fair skin with brown hair? Why doesn't he look like a black man? Or people are upset that all of the people that are portrayed in this series don't look closer to what we know that people at that time living in that area looked like. And then there was the whole controversy that people were saying that the devil was portrayed to look like Barack Obama, and all these things. I think it is indicative of the fact that we as a world community still are very tied to feeling like God and Jesus Christ and the people in the Bible or our spiritual leaders of that time look a certain way. And I think that the play and the idea that God is a woman or a black woman. It just plays with our understanding of God. I really don't think it matters, though, whether God is a woman or a black woman or a man or a black man. I think God is spirit, and that so often when we put these tight grips on what God is, what God expects, what God needs from us, how perfect we need to be, how we make it further and further away for us to measure up. Mm-hmm. Whereas God loves us regardless of what we look like, who we are, what we do, if we curse, if we don't, as long as we love God and are faithful, that's all God asks for. He doesn't ask for perfection. And I think that, you know, the playing with that idea is nice and it's fun, but it doesn't change my love of God any more than I think it should change anyone else's. I think the fact is just that God is spirit and God loves us, and that's all that matters.
Yeah. Well, currently there's an exhibit up in San Francisco at the African American Art and Culture Complex in the Sergeant Johnson Gallery, mm-hmm. and it is Black Woman is God. Mm-hmm. And so I saw that exhibit the afternoon before I came to the play.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, oh my goodness. Yeah,
I'm sure that had a lot of meaning for you. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, it must be in the air or something. And, you know, since you're from Detroit, then you know about the Nation of Islam's legacy, because Temple One, where Ilan Elijah Muhammad established it, was in Detroit, Michigan, and I grew up in the Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm. And so the black man is God, and the black woman was the queen of the universe. And so, mm-hmm. and I agree with you, you know, these are, you know, sort of putting human aspects onto, you know, creator, which mm-hmm. which is bigger than us.
Right.
But just you think about sort of what that does to our sense of ourselves, if we think of mm-hmm. ourselves as, you know, as great as that. Mm-hmm. So then we don't do things that are not great. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, using that as a metaphor, I just think it's, you know, with Kame and Martin King and just sort of playing with those notions as Katori Hall does with the writing and the characters. And then when, you know, the wonderful images that are shown in the end that just show us just how great we really are,
right?
You know, as a nation, as a nation of change makers, you know, mm-hmm. the regular folks are doing mm-hmm. it too.
I think without Martin Luther King, there could have been no Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the if we really look at what happened after his death in this country and how much, not just this country, but the world changed, the abolishment of apartheid, being able to see Nelson Mandela as the leader of a country that that incarcerated him for more than half of his life. I mean, mm-hmm. just those changes that we've seen in our nation as a result of this one man is amazing. But then we can also look at the way that the world is today. I mean, even just in the Bay Area, the highest level of homelessness, some of the highest numbers of people who are homeless and hungry in the country, but then also a county that is, Marin County is one of the wealthiest counties in America. Mm-hmm. To have Silicon Valley and so much wealth concentrated in one area, and then to see underneath these huge, monstrous buildings, people sleeping outside on the ground, people still hungry, people still without. And that is not something that is odd to us as a country. You know, we see homeless people and we see people that are hungry, and it does not shock us. And yet Martin Luther King was dealing with the same thing 40, 50 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that there were people starving to death in Mississippi, in one of the wealthiest nations in America. And so, yes, we've had immense progress and change, but we still have a long way to go, not just with our racial differences, but also with our the care that we have for our fellow man. I think, you know, we have a long way to go, and so the images that are brought up at the end of the play they inspire hope,
mm-hmm.
but they also, you know, the playwright says the baton passes on. There's
yes.
still more work to be done, and
mm-hmm.
we still have, somebody has to pick up the torch.
Right, yeah.
Pieces like this have to be put on,
mm-hmm.
and people have to walk away from them with a sense of, I need to help make a change in my community.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I can't go and change the nation like Martin Luther King did, but I could change my community. I can go and donate clothes or my time or money to kids who don't have parents in the house, or veterans,
mm-hmm.
or women who are without equal pay and equal rights. As a country and as a world, we still have to be concerned and look out for our fellow man. And I think that's one of the things that Dr. King really tried to stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. I certainly agree. And I'm sure you just had a matinee performance today, and I'm sure you maybe can share with us, you know, how the young people that see the play, do they get a chance to talk to you afterwards about their impressions?
We do. We do have talkbacks
mm-hmm.
After almost all of our shows, our student matinees. We didn't have one today, but mm-hmm. we have had them at every other performance. And then I've also had the pleasure of mm-hmm. going to speak to high schools. I'm speaking to another high school tomorrow, and Adrian has had the opportunity to go and speak to high school students as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting, especially within the Palo Alto community, which is still very wealthy, to look and see what kids are really concerned with nowadays. And their impression of the play. You know, we had one young lady, a young African-American girl, stand up, and she said that this play has changed her entire perspective on America and history, and she was just very thankful
mm-hmm.
for what we did and what we showed her. But this is one black girl who looked like one of maybe three in a school or in an auditorium of over 100.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I question, you know, what it is that our kids are learning nowadays. I mean, one of the schools that I spoke to, one of the girls said, you know, I really don't know that much about Martin Luther King. And I think that is unfortunately the norm. I don't think that a lot of our children are being taught history the same way that they were before. And so if their parents aren't giving it to them, they don't really have much to go off of. So when they see this play, it's a lot of information for them to take in.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the references maybe don't land the same way because they weren't taught the history of it, but they do recognize just the greatness of King as a man, and they enjoy being able to see him kind of playing around, being
mm-hmm.
a regular human being. And
right.
and they also recognize that in their current time, there are issues that they can stand up and speak to. There are a lot of kids that I spoke to that are very concerned with gay and lesbian rights within this country,
mm-hmm.
as well as the abuse of women, you know, crimes against women that go unprosecuted or unsolved. And that was something that was very, very important to these students that I spoke to, as well as how we're treating our environment. And it's interesting, you know, that is what kids are most passionate about nowadays. But I think it was perhaps just the students that I spoke to, because I'm sure if this production was put on for kids in Oakland, their perspective, the things that they're concerned about, might be a little bit different.
Yeah.
Might be a lot bit different.
Yeah. But also, you know, in the same area where you are in Palo Alto, there's, you know, Little Nairobi or East Palo Alto, where it was actually that particular part of Palo Alto was trying to get its own, you know, sort of become its own city, but that didn't happen.
Did
so I guess you didn't get a chance to go talk to any of those children?
No, nor have I even heard of that area. This is my first time in Northern California, and so.
Oh really? Oh, I hope you come back.
Absolutely, I love it here, but the where the theater is situated, it definitely gives you a different energy, and a different response to the play that I think maybe if put in another area wouldn't be the same response. I mean, our assistant director, a young man named Brandon, expressed that he had seen the production done in Philly.
Oh,
and the responses that people had to certain things were completely different. And so when we were rehearsing, we were trying to prepare ourselves for what would happen if people, you know, were upset hearing Kane curse or were gasping if they heard him smoke.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? All of these things that culturally people might react to differently. And I've only done this production here, so every audience is different every night. The makeup of every audience is different, but based on the background, the racial background, the economic background, every performance is different. The age of the audience makes it a significant impact on how people react to it. Because there are some people who grew up during this, and one woman cried during a talk back because she remembered when Martin Luther King was killed, and that was earth-shattering to her because she felt like, what are we as a country going to do if this is what we do to a man like this? And this was a woman in her 60s maybe, an older white woman, and it's still significant to her, whereas for younger children, it doesn't have the same impact. And so I have not been exposed to those communities, but I would have loved to see what, say, a school from that area, how they reacted to this same piece. Because it's all energy for us as actors to be able to feel what people feel. And, you know, kids respond to different things than the adults do. So
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to get a party together of some women who are formerly incarcerated for, in most of them, the average is like over 20 years. And I'm a member of the board for California Coalition for Women Prisoners. And we've gone on, you know, some we've gone out to events like this, and I think they would really, really enjoy seeing you and Adrian sort of bring breathing life into these wonderful characters. This is a great, great story. I mean, it's just a phenomenal story. So I'm looking forward to your coming back to visit us. And,
Thank you.
And maybe with one of your plays or in another production.
Yes,
I really
look forward to that opportunity too.
Yeah, and lastly, because I know we've gone over, I just wanted to mention that I just finished reading a book called The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, and it's by Jean Theo Harris, Dr. Jean Theo Harris. And Rosa Parks, she moved to your fair city. And that's where she, lived until she made a transition because they could no longer live in Birmingham because it was just so hostile, once she, started, the bus boycott. People don't think about how her family suffered and, not being able to find work. But she just kept on, speaking and doing her engagements. And then the suffering that they had, like with the ulcers and, the stress and how that affected her heart and all of that. And also Malcolm X gave his last speech there before he was killed. I mean, so many things happened. Like, you just like in sort of like this great place where the energy is just so heavy duty.
Yeah.
The Republic of New Africa was founded there. oh my goodness.
I definitely recognize that coming from Detroit, I've had a different history than a lot of people that I know. and a different upbringing. Mm-hmm. I had the fortune of, I can't even go, I could go on and on, but I know one thing specifically. I went to a school called Bates Academy, which was called the School for the Gifted and Talented. And it was predominantly African American. And so growing up as a kid, I did not have a shackle on my mind of how smart I could be, or that black children couldn't achieve excellence educationally or in sports or in anything, because I went to a school with almost all black kids that were all exceptionally intelligent. And then every year for Black History Month, for the entire month, we would study African-American history, African history as well as African-American history, the entire school from kindergarten through eighth grade. We would all be given a binder where we would have to study every fact, not just, oh, did Garrett Morgan invent the stoplight and Carver did the peanut. It was every invention, every achievement, every leader, everything about black culture. And that created such a basis and a background for me that I recognize that my peers don't necessarily have if they grew up somewhere else, as well as children who grew up today don't have that. So growing up in Detroit, seeing a city with black mayors, black councilmen, and leaders, it completely molded who I am as a person and what I think is possible to achieve, because I grew up in such a strong city, and unfortunately our city isn't doing the best right now, but having all of that history there does affect the children. We are the we are the product of our soil, and so Detroit definitely has great soil.
Right, yeah. And you're a classically trained violinist, and you went to Howard University, and you have a BA in English and a theater minor. And then after you graduated, you went over to England to study at Oxford, study theater there. And then you've also been in film, and you were in a film that got Best Diaspora Film in the Kenyan Film Awards recently, like last year, right?
Yeah, that film also was nominated for Best Short Film in the African Movie Awards, which is their version of the Oscars.
That's amazing. You should put that in the in your note, like.
I know. It was a great experience, and you know, all the work that I've done has been just the product of God's grace, and I'm thankful for every day that I get to do what I love, because a lot of people don't get to in their lives and in their careers, and so very thankful for where I've ended up.
So after Sunday, are you going back to Southern California, and what are you working on?
I am. I'm going back, and I'm working on being a wife and sitting myself still. I haven't seen my husband consistently in about a month and a half. He's sitting right here, but it's been difficult because he's also an actor. He's on the show Southland on TNT. He plays Detective Reuben Robinson, who's Regina King's partner. And so he was working throughout most of the run of the show. So we've been apart. So I think we're just both going to sit still for a little while, but then only a short while, because it's always back to work. And I don't know where God is going to put me next, but I'm just going to show up and audition and see what happens.
Do you have a website or anything?
I do. It's SimoneCook.com, my maiden name. So SimoneCook.com.
Okay, super. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to come back and see you on the closing performance on Sunday matinee, and hopefully I'll be able to bring some folks with me.
Please do. Thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you so much for this wonderful gift you brought us with your character, Kameh. Time she is sort of called to life, you know, the actress who portrays her, you know, brings, you know, her take on this spirit, right? So anyway, I haven't seen her in any other light besides the one that you presented her in, and I just really like her.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for all of your wonderful work in making this play what it is, and it's so fabulous.
And thank you for the work that you're doing and for your radio show and everything, just getting this production out to people. We definitely appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, you take good care, and I'll see you on
too.
Sunday.
All right. Thanks, Wanda.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was actress Simone Missick speaking about her role as Camille in the current production of The Mountaintop, Katori Hall's work that is starring Miss Missick as well as Adrian Roberts. And the play is up through Sunday, April 7th, and there's a special performance, there's a special guest at the performance tomorrow, which is the anniversary, I believe it's the 45th anniversary of Martin King being killed in Memphis at the Lorraine Motel, and that is Dr. Claiborne Carson, who is a scholar at Stanford University, and he's going to be speaking. I'm not certain. I think he's going to be speaking actually before the performance Thursday evening, April 4th. So for all the information, you can visit theaterworks.org, theater spelled T-H-E-A-R-E, and then works, W-R-K-S.org, or you can call 650-463-1960. So we're going to play a piece from Sweet Honey and the Rock, and then I'm going to play another interview. I had planned on playing the interview with Dr. Jean Theo Harris, talking about her wonderful new work, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. However, I'm still having some technical difficulties with that interview, and so I'm not going to be able to do that until next Wednesday. So stay tuned, and it's definitely going to be worth the wait. It's a wonderful, wonderful interview. It's quite lengthy. So now I'm going to play the Sweet Honey and the Rock piece, Hope.
If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to pray on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to pray on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to pray on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to pray on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to pray on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to pray on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to work on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to work on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to teach on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to teach on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to fight on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to fight on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to sing on. If we want hope to survive in this world today, then every day we've got to sing on.
Interview with Aya De Leon, recorded last year in anticipation of the wonderful June Jordan Porgy for the People's 20th anniversary celebration at UC Berkeley.
Just my imagination. Renee Marie singing Just My Imagination, and we had a great interview with her about a year ago when she was coming through town with her latest CD, which includes Lift Every Voice, sung to the tune of Star Spangled Banner, really wonderful rendition. And so about a year ago and a half, actually, maybe a little less than that, we had her on the air to talk about her, what she's been up to. So here is Renee Marie in a pre-recorded interview, and we hope that Aya De Leon will be calling in to talk about Poetry for the People, June Jordan's Poetry for the People, which is 20 years old
now.
Hold on,
Javelin.
They're having a wonderful 20th anniversary celebration this weekend, Friday and Saturday, March 16th and 17th at UC.
Well, we are not going to be able to play that after all because we are out of time and we are joined in the studio by Javelin Richards, one of our wonderful artists here in the San Francisco Bay Area. She's going to be talking to us about her nappy-headed love story series, which folks will be able to, which is really wonderful for us, be able to see them all sort of one after another, you know, like a big festival of her work. That's so exciting, Javelin. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about that and the fundraiser that you're having presently to raise money to be able to put on such an extravaganza.
Good morning. Good morning. It's good to join you this morning and talk about the nappy-headed love stories.
Yeah, so why don't you tell us about this whole premise, and then I'll you know, stop you and we can introduce you properly for those who do not know you, and I don't know how that's possible with your, you know, wonderful women's, let's see, what is it, the KPFA, what is it, the women's...
Cover to cover. That's the recently I've been working for the last year on Cover to Cover Open Book, which is Arts and Humanities, which airs live on Fridays, and I'm on every third Friday for KPFA, and then also every now and then I will go back and do work with Women's Magazine.
Oh.
I and a group of other women started the Women's Magazine about 5 or 6 years ago, and so for a while I was doing Welcome to Javelin's World, and then I left for a while. Went off to Budapest, came back, and then rejoined KPFA's family and started doing Cover to Cover Open Book.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm glad you sent me a current bio because I thought you were still doing the Women's Magazine.
I still will work with them. Primarily, I know that people can find me on Cover to Cover Open Book every third Friday, and then there's other shows that I'll cover from, like Chris Welch. I'll every now sit down and host for her. So it just depends, but then I know that folks will get me on Cover to Cover Open Book.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Excellent.
So the nappy-headed love stories, essentially, when I began to write this series in 2008, I wanted to reclaim the word nappy, and I wanted, as I define it, as an adjective, to curl, to bond, to twist, to grow naturally, to... create conversation, to be indigenous. And so it was really about my own natural hair and the feelings as an African-American woman growing up and the notion that one had to straighten one's hair. And so therefore straighten oneself out. And I also know that it was becoming a part of the media off and on in some of the celebrities' lives, in the world in terms of looking at their hair, particularly as women, as opposed to the work that they were doing in the world. So I wanted to create the nappy-headed love stories for those of us who can extract love in ourselves and our lives. And when I put that question to myself as a writer and performance artist, I wanted to create characters who represented that, and one of the first characters that came to me was out of Come Home, which you saw, was Donna Ray. So the characters are set in the backdrop of atrocities throughout African-American history, but out of that, what you have an opportunity to see is their own voice and how they react to their personal lives, not just to the tragedies, but their personal lives, meaning their immediate relationships with family and friends. And out of that, they still maintain a sense of love, starting with themselves and then moving forward. So I created this series essentially to give voice to women and children, also because they don't have as many opportunities. We have not had as many opportunities throughout history to give voice to what we feel or think in the immediate, situation that's being presented. So that could be, in many cases, how do women and children feel about if they happen to be living in poverty? How do women and children feel about being in the middle of a war? How do women and children feel about the world of academics? We just go in the school that they go to. How do they feel? How do they feel about the political, social times they live in? How do they feel as it is particular to their circumstances? And so the characters get an opportunity to express that, but it's not from a political, social point of view. It's from an emotional point of view. How do I feel? And so I take those stories and put them in situations so they can express that through their everyday living.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You have a MFA, and you're a published writer and solo performers mm-hmm. artist residing in Oakland, California presently.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, that you're a radio host now for Cover to Cover, open mm-hmm. book on KPFA 94.1. And your work has been presented at the Minnesota Fringe Festival, the San Francisco Festival, La Pena Cultural Center, Berkeley, California, The March, which is where I first saw you in that wonderful piece, Come Home, in San Francisco, and then you also performed at Afro Solo Festival, where I saw your latest, piece in the series, Sweet Baby, which I really, really loved. Every time you see one, it's like, oh, I think that's my favorite now. Well, no.
Right, right.
Yeah, and then I saw you when you did the piece in San Francisco at the smaller space, and I don't know what the
mm-hmm.
name of that piece was.
It's The Garage.
The piece was called? No, The Garage was played.
The theater is called The Garage.
Right, what was the piece called?
That was Stripping Down to Stories.
Yeah, yeah, and that was about a burlesque artist.
Right, woman who had became a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
She's part of the series. So the series that I'm presenting now or raising money to present is three generations of women. So in Afro Solo, you were able to see Mama, who was enslaved all of her life, born into slavery, and she was set free, of course, in 1865, technically set free. And so this was her. So in Afro Solo Fest, you had an opportunity to see 3 days of her traveling after she's been told you've been freed by the mistress of the plantation. And so there's a... On this plantation, there's a group of Negroes. They've been called to the plantation home, and the woman is on the balcony, and she says, you've been freed. President Lincoln has freed ya. And then she jumps over the balcony and hangs herself. So this leaves Mama and the other Negroes wondering, well, what is freedom? What does freedom mean whatever it means that this woman has just hung herself? So that is 3 days of her walking with her last remaining child of six. She's given birth to six while enslaved. And five of them have been sold into slavery. And she has one remaining child that's 6 months old, and her name is Sweet Baby. And so what you saw is Mama. I'm going to present Sweet Baby at the National Black Theater Festival in North Carolina. But the one you saw at The Garage in San Francisco, because I jumped over last year to present the third generation, which is Diane Edwards, who became a doctor, a Negro doctor in the 1930s. But because she's a woman, because she's a Negro, the challenges she was faced with, stripped her of her medical degree, isolated her from the black community then because of her skin color. She was a color of a dark berry, and internalized racism as well as racism as well as sexism. Those challenges she has now become to support herself, a striptease artist in one of the most upscale clubs in Harlem. So it's three generations of women and how racism, sexism, and their social positioning in this culture, what it has done to their lives and how they have been able to find the love at the core of their lives, who they are. They are choosing love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just thinking about the protagonists in the stories that I've seen of yours,
mm-hmm.
You know, starting with Sweet Baby and working our way back to Miss Pat's Miss Pat.
Mm-hmm.
These women are alone.
They are alone in one sense.
Mm-hmm.
But they are always surrounded by a community of people for the most part. And like in Miss Pat's house, she runs a brothel. Miss Pat's house has always been a part of, in August, I usually do it at La Pena Culture Center. And the theme of Miss Pat's house is that it is a brothel set in Cleveland, Ohio, in the 1930s during a depression. And it's sort of rethinking about the way we think of brothels. So most people familiar with Richard Pryor knows he was raised in a brothel. What we don't, so that sort of began that conversation to look at brothels, particularly in African-American communities. The brothels that I was aware of growing up in the Midwest, what we understood about them is they were a go-to place. Not just a go-to place for folks in terms of sex. It had nothing to do with that. But it was a go-to place for women in the community who did not have anything. And so the women who ran the brothels would give away groceries. They would pay the grocery bills at stores. That's when they had corner stores, and they still do now. But you could have credit. That was like the first credit extended to black people. 60s, 70s, 80s, and even in some places now. I was at a gas station here in Oakland, and a woman came in, and the I guess he's the owner of the shop. She was getting some of her needs on credit until she, you know, was paid whenever she got paid. And so brought some of the women who ran the brothels would pay those bills to ease up those challenging times. And so they're alone, and yet they create a community. So when Miss Pat's, that brothel held, the people that worked there, lived there, were people who had nowhere else to go in life. For instance, Miss Lucy. Miss Lucy was 101 years old when she went to the brothel. And so where at that time could she have gone? When at that particular time, in the 70s, there, you know, she had nowhere really to go. And so she went and said, I'll cook, I'll wash clothes, I'll keep company. I know how to dust, I can do all the things I can still do at 101 years old. So they create family with one another. And even in stripping down to stories, with Dr. Diane Edwards, who has now become just Diane Edwards, exclusive striptease artist. She also has a community of the women around her, other women who have come there because they have nowhere else to really go. They may come because they love the glamour. They may come because it seems like an exciting life, as particularly the Cotton Club and the other places that people would go to have a certain level of celebrity status in this culture. And for women, it usually tends to be, you know, as singers, as striptease artists, you know, in the 30s, 40s, and very few black women in the film industry. So whatever reasons that they get there, they were able to create a certain form of community with one another, because you have that kinship of just the industry you're working in. You have the details that make you automatically sort of say, I understand, or I don't understand, or I have a question that one would not be able to address. Let's just say if you have a paper route. I know that's an extreme, but you just have the particulars of the club. You know how to say to a person, well, those feathers are not going to last you through that song. You need to have a bobby pin to put them feathers in to secure it better. If you go out there that way, you will be naked in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. So they had each one, although alone, they do find ways in which to have a community, just sort of a natural rhythm.
Right. Yeah, I really like Mama and in Sweet Baby, and how she remembers her husband. And that's just so beautiful, you know, when he before he passes, you know, he tells her, you know, that I think he tells her that he's in the rain.
What he says is, and again, that this is another way of she's alone. So here's this woman, Mama, who's walking for 3 days after the mistress has said, use free, with her last remaining baby. She's walking alone, and yet she creates community with memory. So when she talks about the Sweet Baby's daddy, they weren't legally married in this particular story because they were from the same plantation. And when they brought him to the plantation, it's like the earth moved under her. She had never experienced the affections of love, just the tenderness of someone smiling, saying, hey, I like you, because she was enslaved, and the rules of her enslavement was just for breeding purposes. So the rules of her enslavement was for breeding purposes, and she didn't have any other luxury outside of that or any other notion outside of that. That was what she knew to be true. So when they bring him to the plantation, he changes that by the way he sees her, that he has an immediate drawn to her that obviously is beyond slavery, enslavement. They began a love affair in the way that they can. So, for instance, as they're working during the day, she's going down this row behind the other folks enslaved, and they have this rhythm and this sound, and they're keeping up the movement of the day, the work day, and they're moving with a beat together. And she rises up, and everybody rises up together in unison. And then he rises up 4 rows down. And it's time to eat, so everybody's pulling out what they have to eat. He has the biscuit. He passes the biscuit in rhythm, and everybody knows where that biscuit is going. And they rise up, because now they're all in unison, because everybody knows that something different has happened, like a bumblebee to a flower. And they rise up in protection of one another, because they don't want those that are patrolling the area to know that there's a love affair going on. But they all get it in their hearts and their spirit. He hands her a biscuit. She bites where he bit. He's bitten off the biscuit. She bites where he bit, so her mouth has been where his mouth has been. And they rise up, and she passed the biscuit back, and then he takes the biscuit. When they decide to be with one another in the field and other folks protect them, the hidden stories that we don't know, how did people have love affairs enslaved? How did that happen? We all know that to be true. It's no different than when you and, like, I remember being in junior high school. My mother worked at the school. I had a boyfriend. She had no clue. We snuck off and had cinnamon kisses. And to this day, my mother swear there's no way her kids did anything, because she worked at the school. She was there to walk us home and to and from. But I had my first cinnamon kiss while she was working at school. You find places, quarters, back rooms, alleys. You will find a way to get that need met. And so in this particular case, under those extreme circumstances, they found a way to be lovers. To one another, as we would call it today, they were lovers. And whatever they called it then, we may not know, or I don't know. But then one day she puts her hand on her belly to let him know, I have a child in me. And everything inside of him turns, because he knows that this will mean, he knows her plight, he knows the history, and he knows that he cannot let one more child come from between her thighs and be handed over. Not if he's to be him. Now, that's probably whatever he felt probably was going way back in his bone into his ancestors. So they take off and they run. And in the midst of running, he realizes, too, that the probability of them getting caught is higher than them getting to freedom, but he needed to do this. So he says to her, if anything should happen to me, I will be your rain. And he takes her shoulder. He says, now listen to me. If anything should happen to me, I will be your rain. On the day, and they're caught, and on the day that they're brought back, she's beat pretty bad, and she is, the rest of her life, the scars are on her face and on her back. He is killed in front of the other Negroes to show, because the reason he came to this plantation is because he's a runner and he's a fighter. And while they are killing him, they force her and others to watch. And in that moment, his words come back to her. And he looks at her moments before he lets go of life. And she looks at him and she lifts her head and tilts her mouth to let in the rain, to remind him, because it's not really physically raining, but she's letting him know that for the rest of my life, whenever it rains, I will open my mouth if you have asked, because you be rain, and I will let you in. So they have that, and for the rest of Mama's life, whenever it rains, she goes outside and just opens her mouth and just takes her clothes off and stands there.
Yeah, that is a moment. Oh, my goodness.
It is a moment.
Yeah, it is a wonderful moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just, you know, taking something so terrible and traumatic and blessing it. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, that's the word, blessing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that I am in love with. The thought that, and I love that you put that language on it too, because that's the truth of it, to take something so horrible in many ways and put a blessing of love on it, because you can't stop what's happening, but you can choose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even an intellectual choice. It is a choice of spirit, the choice of heart, and that is the blessing. When the heart and spirit chooses to say, here, in all of this, here. And he says, if anything happens to me, I be rain. Open your mouth and let me in. And that's like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a writer, it was like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
And performing it on stage, it was like, wow. You know, you can't write or experience that, I can't, without becoming a part of that truth.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So I was reading, mm-hmm. you know, what you sent me about the stories, and
mm-hmm.
And then you say that you actually have a final production of the Nappy series. It doesn't go on and on and on and on. Yeah. Sweet Baby's going to grow up and something. Yeah.
Sweet Baby.
Yeah.
I'm writing Sweet Baby. And she will first walk out on the stage, to my knowledge. That means that something may happen prior to, but
mm-hmm.
at the National Black Theater Festival that opens July 9th, and I think it runs to August 4th in North Carolina, Sweet Baby, Maw, this woman who opens her mouth and lets the rain in, her last remaining child, the child of her and the slave who ran with her or took her into running and gave her that poetic blessed moment that is now past, their child, Sweet Baby, it's like the question becomes, what happens to a child that is the firstborn into freedom? So this, for me, became environment versus nurture. What happens, to look at that question psychologically, what happens to Sweet Baby? How does Mama love if she's only known enslavement? If she's been, is it trauma? You know, she doesn't have that language that we have access to, that I've been traumatized or I'm psychologically misplaced in my head. She had no language. She only knew the facts of her life. So how do you walk into freedom? Find out what freedom really means now in the South, Reconstruction period and on. What does it mean? How do I live? What do I do? And how do I raise this baby? What am I supposed to do? And so this is the story of Sweet Baby. Sweet Baby. Because she named, Mama named all of her children as they were being taken from her. They say, Mama, what you going to name that baby? And she would say to them, this baby's name is Sweet Baby. And they would take the baby. So this is the story of what happens to Sweet Baby. How does she grow up? What does she do? How does she act? What are her challenges? How does Mama, can she show her love? A mother and daughter's relationship is all of that. A mother and daughter's relationship, doing the first generation born into freedom. And we know that that has its own different meanings, but that's not my worries when I write. All that's the backdrop. I want to know emotionally about Sweet Baby, and that's what she's going to tell you, her story. And what I know to be true in this moment is that it is a love affair. They have the deepest love, and I don't mean when I say love affair, people start thinking, oh, my God, are we talking into this? Folks, put your coffee cup down and say, oh, my gosh. This is a love story is a better word maybe to say. This is one of the most intense love stories. Mama is everything that Mama ever imagined freedom to be for her. When she was bent down in soul, bent down under the beat of the sun, beat down in rhythm with others who were enslaved, beat down in labor when someone was waiting to pull that child from her so there was nothing called attachment, when she was running inside of the woods and listening to dogs and listening to the horse's hooves and coming down, when she saw the man she loves pregnant by break the neck of a first dog, this is Mama now when she was imagining those moments, God, please help us, help us, help us, when she's imagining what it could be like not to be bent down. Like, what do you imagine if all you've known is being bent down? Now you imagine, I wonder what's it like if I could stand up and just walk over there and get some water. So everything she imagined, everything in her memory, collected memories that she don't even know about, comes running up to her, and she places it in front of Sweet Baby. So that love affair, so Sweet Baby is for her freedom. No matter what the politics, no matter what is happening in Mississippi for her, Sweet Baby, no matter how others are defining what the South is and what freedom is going to be, she hears all that. She knows all that, and she will deal with all that in the way that she can and cannot. But freedom for her is a love affair of Sweet Baby. Like, for instance, there's a road, and Sweet Baby is the learning to walk. So they sit on the porch. Sweet Baby steps up and crawls, and rises up from crawling. Kind of does the thing babies do. They do on one leg, the other, and they drop down on their little booties and their butts, and they smile. You go, you can do it, Sweet Baby. She does it again, and then by the time she can really walk, she's going down that road, and Mama stands at the foot of the porch and sees her walking down the road a little bit, kind of running as babies do, wobbly, wobbly. And then she goes, let's her run, let's her. And you go, oh, Sweet Baby, come back. And she runs, but when she lets her go just a little further, in her head, she's thinking, I could have never run that far without being whooped, beat. I could have never run that far. She doesn't think it, but you see it in her eyes, in her face, and she says, run, run. Oh, come back, Sweet Baby. And that becomes one of the ways in which they play. It becomes play. And as Sweet Baby gets older, she teases her now. Now Sweet Baby just takes off running. And she laughs at Sweet Baby and laughs until she can barely see her. And then she hollers, Sweet Baby. And Sweet Baby come back and run back and jump in her arms. And they laugh and hug and go, oh, Sweet Baby. Oh, and she go, I ran, Mama. I ran. And she, you sure did run, baby. Oh, Lord, I didn't think I was going to see you. And that becomes an example of their love affair. When she runs back and jumps in her mama's arm and her mama holds her. But as she holds her tight, what we know to be true is she's probably thinking, oh, my God, how wonderful it must have been to be 6 years old and be able to run. And so it becomes a love affair until one day on that same road in which they began that love affair of a baby learning to walk, crawl, to walk, to run back, to crawl, to walk, to run, to run, to run. And she leaves. She leaves to go out into the world in 1908 in her 40s. Sweet baby's now 40-some years old, and she leaves to go out into the world down that road. She looks over her shoulder and says, I see you, Mama. And she goes, sweet baby. She says, I see you, Mama. Sweet baby, I see you, Mama. Sweet baby, I see you, Mama. Sweet baby, I see you, Mama. And she's gone. That's freedom for her. She's gone off with a, she met somebody who knew how to sing and knew how to play a harmonica. She's following the notes of that harmonica.
Mm-hmm.
So so this story that opens at the National Black Festival, you know, will happen, Sweet Baby, but it's also the series that I'm, so what I want to do in this fundraiser, which we have 41 hours left on Indiegogo, is I want to be able to have the three generations of the women, Mama's story first, where she's first told by the plantation mistress, Use Free, and then the story of the next night, the story of Mama, her daughter, Sweet Baby, have her story, and then the third night to have Dr. Diane Edwards. So we have an opportunity to see each woman's life over the generations, starting in 1865 to 1936. Three generations of women, African-American women, what their lives were like during this time frame in history, and what happened in their lives, and what did love look like for them. And so we're raising money. A part of it, too, is to bring black, the series, bring the voices of, again, as I started, we started in our interview, black voices of women and children in the forefront of our consciousness. And so myself, when I say we, I work with musicians on stage. I also work in collaboration with Dr. Stephanie Ann Johnson. She is my artistic collaborator and light designer for each show. She creates these incredible ways of illuminating the characters on stage so we can have relationship with light and darkness on stage. And so to put that all together, we're trying to raise the goal, the initial goal was to raise, is to raise $10,000, which covers a theater, rehearsal, production cost, publicity, all the details, the grocery list of theater. And to raise 1 month each weekend, the series runs. And we are running it now on Indiegogo with 41 hours left to raise. I think we've raised maybe what percentage? We've raised $1,200 of the $10,000. Well, a little bit more than that because I had one donor just send us a check that did not show on Indiegogo. So $1,500. We've raised up to $10,000, and we have 41 hours left before the campaign closes.
Okay.
I know.
Well, Javelin, my next guest, hold on, Conda Mason. She's going to be talking about the benefits for East Bay Meditation Center tomorrow on April 4th, The Dream Never Dies, a conversation on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s beloved community and where we go from here with Alice Walker, Jack Kornfield, Michael Bernard Beckwith, and with musical performances by Ricky Byers Beckwith and Roz Kennedy. So that's going to be really exciting at Zellerbach. So I just thought, you know, what you're talking about with regards to these stories and freedom is the beloved community, right?
Yes.
So, you know, at its, you know, it's a philosophy and a space that we have to continue to create and recreate, you know, within our community.
Mm-hmm.
Which is so wonderful that you show us these stories and these women whose lives are connected. And I won't give it away, this last one, because I'm like, oh, really? When I was reading, I'm like, oh. But I thought, well, I shouldn't say that, right? You know, how the last story is connected to the some of the other stories, because I thought that might be like the punchline.
Or maybe
I could ask the question. It looks like Sweet Baby is the doctor that we meet, who's the burlesque performer.
It's her daughter. It's Sweet Baby's baby. When she leaves Mama, when she leaves, she gives birth. She's 42 when she gives birth in 19, exactly. And her, and she comes back. That's the granddaughter. She is the granddaughter of Mama.
Okay.
So Sweet Baby has a baby, and her, so it's three generations.
Gotcha.
And people can read more about the stories on Indiegogo.
They can
go to Indiegogo.com and look up the Nappy Headed Love series, and there's I've written the narrative. But then also can go to my website, which would take them to Indiegogo, which gives an opportunity for those who would like to contribute to the campaign. And my website is www.javelin, which is JOVELYN, richards.com. And I think, these internet searches are sometimes funny, but sometimes when I click on to go to www.javelinrichards.com, it'll click to Google, but at the top it'll say Javelin Richards, and then it will, I think it says, Welcome to Javelin's World. If you click it, that goes to the website, or just go to Indiegogo and then put in Nappy Headed Love Stories, and it should take you right to the page.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much, Javelin, for joining us to talk about your capital campaign, as well as this new and final chapter in this series of wonderful stories. Each one is my favorite.
I love that. That's funny. I like that. Thank you for the opportunity to talk this morning and to say hello to your listeners. This has been wonderful.
I thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Good morning, Conda Mason. How are you?
Good morning. I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'm so happy that you have put together this great way to honor Martin King on the anniversary of his passing, which is the 45th, right?
Right. Actually, this year is the 45th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, which was April 4th, 1968.
Yeah. So tell us about your program and how you came to want to do this particular program with these particular people. I could definitely say, wow, there's like a wonderful assembly of people that we all really love and love their work and how activism is their lives. And yeah, it's like, I don't know how you're going to like it. Oh, the program starts at what time? 7?
At 7.
Yeah, 7 o'clock. And are we going to ever go home, or are we just going to just go into the next day and the day after that? Because this is the end of the season of peace, right? And
Right.
Yeah, so we need some direction now. Okay, the season of peace officially, ends on the 4th, but it doesn't end because being a peacemaker never really ends. So what are our tasks? Like, give us our, what do we do now? Give us our work.
Right. Well, the first thing you do is you come to the show on Thursday and tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing you do, because the wisdom that's going to be there is pretty outstanding. I mean, as you said, it's a really stellar group of visionaries, activists, spiritualists who are coming together within those three human beings who will be there. Jack Kornfield is he started Spirit Rock Meditation Center, which is like I would say it's probably the biggest, or one of the biggest Buddhist meditation centers in the country here in the Bay Area. It's in Marin County. And so he is the person who started that, the founder of Spirit Rock Meditation Center. And he is just an incredibly just knowledgeable scholar on Buddhist theory, Buddhist practice. He was a monk himself in Southeast Asia, and is just a brilliant heart, full heart man, and is just going to be amazing to have on the panel. And then we have Alice Walker, who I think hopefully listeners know as the Pulitzer Prize winning author of The Color Purple, and many, many, many books before and after that, and is an activist, a spiritualist, amazing person on the forefront of human dignity in general, and a lot to say about a lot of things. And so we've got Alice Walker, poet as well, who will be on the panel. And then we've got Michael Bernard Beckwith, who many people know as Reverend Michael, from the Agape Center of Spiritual Center in Los Angeles. And he is the founder of Agape in LA. He's just, what do you say about Michael other than amazing, visionary, and incredible man with lots of wisdom and just flowing from his mouth. Many people from the Bay Area, I'm finding several people, particularly in East Bay, are not as familiar with Michael as they are with Jack and Alice. And boy, all I can say is come on out to hear Michael. He is an amazing visionary. And so the three of them will be speaking. I'll be moderating the panel, and we'll be talking about Dr. King's the Beloved Community, mm-hmm. which is a core concept of Dr. King's work. He really talked a lot about the concept of the Beloved Community and what that looks like. He really believed that that was, you know, something that was possible to achieve. And so we'll be talking about that, and we'll be placing it in the context of today, of the 21st century, you know, the year that we live now, and how possible is it to really achieve that? Are we any closer than we were when Dr. King was alive or not? Because the Beloved Community really for Dr. King was this place where really justice prevailed and every person attained full human potential. Their full human potential, and that, and it was the act, what he considered to be the aftermath after nonviolence on a mass level. So there's a lot to talk about, to see where we are, and these three people have a lot to say about it, and I'm just really excited to be on the stage and really asking them a lot of questions to see what their wisdom comes up with. So I would say that's the place to start, because there's going to be a lot of information and heart coming out of that panel, and not to mention the incredible music that's also going to be on the show.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And you honed your business leadership skills in the entertainment industry as a Grammy-winning artist manager in London, an Academy Award-nominated film producer in Hollywood, and an off-Broadway hit theater producer in New York, just to name a few. Turning your attention to sustainable personal and global living solutions, you are a facilitator, trainer for the Pachamama Alliance, a certified yoga instructor and a partner in Earthseed Consulting, Limited Liability Corporation, where you produce, direct a web series called Green Street Loft, a program aimed at deepening the connection of the African American community with land, place, and the sustainability movement. You were a co-host for the Shift Network's 2012 season of Sustainability, and is often a panelist or moderator in the impact investing space. More recently, you are the founder and CEO of Hub Oakland, LLC, an inspiring space for socially engaged people and social entrepreneurs to create community and bring their projects to life as they create a better world. I'd like to hear more about that. And your leadership style leverages your innate wisdom with tools of permaculture,
sustainable business practices, yoga, storytelling, Buddhist theory, and integral theory. A human equity advocate, certified permaculture designer, and social entrepreneur, your work is driven by the vision of realizing in your lifetime a generally just and sustainable world. So that's how you know these people, huh?
That's pretty much how I know these people, yeah.
Yeah.
They are all actually, you know, not only my heroes and mentors, but personal friends as well, all three of them. And I'm really appreciating them coming to do this as an act of kindness to me and to the East Bay Meditation Center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Sangha, is that like sort of when you give a gift, or an offering?
The Sangha?
Is that Sangha?
The Sangha is the same word. It's a Sanskrit word, which is the language that was spoken in during the Buddhist time. A Sangha is your community. It's like your community of your spiritual community is called your Sangha. So the beloved community is kind of the extended Sangha. And so that's what Sangha is. But generosity, the giving of what you're talking about, is called Dana. Dana, D-A-N-A, Dana. Yeah, Dana is the word for generous giving and giving from the heart. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. I've never met Mr. Cornfield, but have been at Spirit Rock. That was my introduction to meditation and to the Buddhist community, Vipassana in particular. And I just loved. I would go up seasonally for the people of color retreats.
Great.
And I would love being in silence, the silent walks, and then having, the various folks that want to talk. I know one time I think Alice Walker is actually connected to Spirit Rock, and she's, gone up. And I know she's also connected to the East Bay Meditation Center, which we haven't spoken about yet, which is,
that's right,
they're the beneficiaries of this wonderful evening program that you put together for tomorrow, April 4th. Let's talk a little bit about the East Bay Meditation Center and meditation in general. And I like talking about meditation because people don't necessarily understand what it means, to meditate and why it's so good for us to practice this type of reflection and deepening of our spiritual connection to ourselves and to the larger self.
Yeah, very good. That's exactly what it is. So a little bit about the East Bay Meditation Center is that you talked about Spirit Rock, and Spirit Rock is an incredible center, as I said, in Marin County. And what happened is that about six years ago, a group of teachers of color who primarily were coming out of Spirit Rock, although that's not the only place, but primarily coming out of Spirit Rock, feeling the need for a community that was not in Marin, hard to get to, but right in the heart of Oakland, right downtown Oakland, that there was the need for a spiritual center that was teaching basically the one thing that the Buddhist meditation and Vipassana teaches is liberation. Like really just liberation is really what the teaching is based upon. And so personal liberation. And so these teachers came together and were able to create East Bay, which ended up being East Bay Meditation Center, which is right downtown Oakland, in the heart of Oakland, easily accessible by BART, what Jack Kornfield calls actually the most diverse Buddhist center that he's ever seen in the entire world. It is an amazing place where people come. It is extremely diverse. We have several different, every night, well, the last three nights of the week. On Wednesday night, we have a meditation sit that is dedicated to the LGBT community. And then on Thursday night, there's a sit dedicated to the people of color called the POC sit. And Friday is just open to all. everyone. And then every weekend there are programs and workshops and classes, and as well as typically on Monday and Tuesday. So the place is brimming with programs and people, and it is an amazing place. And the other thing that's unique is that there comes the word Donna that I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The programs do not come with a fee. So people, whoever is willing and able to come and needs to come, is welcome. Everyone is welcome, no matter what your socioeconomic position is or your financial position. And so, but what we do have is Donna, which is, it is generosity based. And we encourage people to pay what they can. And so that is how we make our, keep the doors open and the lights on. And this benefit for East Bay Meditation Center is why it's so important, because these are the kinds of tentpole events that we do once a year to actually hopefully bring in the money that really helps us maintain the center. And it is a beautiful center, by the way. It's gorgeous and just brimming with energy and positivity. And so the meditation, you mentioned Vipassana. It is the Vipassana meditation, which is mindfulness, mindfulness meditation. And essentially, meditation is an inner tool that we all have. It's that quiet space. It's that quiet space that we have within us, that when everything settles down a bit and we really just turn inward, and what happens often is that you'll notice that you really aren't so quiet, and the brain just keeps on chattering, and it keeps on chattering, and people think, well, I'm not meditating because my brain, I can't stop the brain. And it is not, I think that that is kind of a misconception of what meditation is. It's like this complete stillness, quiet, the brain just stops thinking, and it's all bliss. And, you know, you will have moments like that, but they are small moments. But it's the process of watching the brain, watching what we're doing, what the brain is always, how it's always chattering. And you begin to see the patterns. You begin to notice things that you don't notice otherwise. And then you also begin to notice the world around you. You notice how you're sitting. You notice the air. You notice the noise outside. All of that is part of the meditation. It's just bringing your attention to it, noticing it, and then coming back to the breath, and how the breath just anchors one. It brings you into that stillness. And so you just continue to watch the play between the mind and the breath, and the body and the breath, and the feelings and the emotions and the breath. And it is an incredible process of liberating yourself from the day-to-dayness of our lives and really becoming still, and understanding that place within you, as well as the teachings, are a lot around liberation. And what I mean by that is liberating ourselves from the tyranny of our minds, because it's really this mind that creates so much suffering for us in the ways that we think and the things and that we do and how we live on the planet. And you start to look at how we are creating our own suffering. And there is suffering out in the world, for sure, but then we add to it by the way we handle things and the way we think about things, and we learn to turn our attention differently in this practice. And it's completely liberating and really an amazing, amazing journey to go on. So I can't encourage it enough. And that's pretty much the kind of teaching that we have at East Bay Meditation Center. And I really invite everyone to come down to the center, which is right on the corner of 17th and Harrison. At the corner of 17th and Harrison in downtown Oakland.
Is that a new space?
That's a new space.
It is a new
space.
Uh-huh.
Yes. We moved recently, and we have a brand new, beautiful space. And we are, we've got a bigger space and a lot more amenities. And so it's really growing, and we need the financial support. So we really need the support of our community.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it used to be really nice on the third Thursdays when I would attend Sister Lola Hanif's Sacred Circle. Sort of be like a changing of the guards.
Oh, great.
because it was in the East Bay Meditation space.
Yeah.
And then we were told that that was shifting, and so now you have another space that's bigger. Wonderful.
Yeah,
same vicinity, with regards to
you know, the general vicinity of downtown Oakland, but a little further, I'm not certain if it's south or what, but going toward the lake.
That's right. Yeah. And it's really beautiful. Yeah, please, you got to come and see the new center. It's lovely.
Oh, definitely. And I want to let people know that you can visit eastbaymeditation.org to find out about all these great classes and sits and fundraisers. They have such fun, some fundraisers. And this one here, this benefit, The Dream Never Dies, oh, my goodness, a conversation on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s beloved community and where we go from here is so in keeping with the whole notion around you know, liberation from suffering, both personal and I guess if one is liberated from suffering, the kind that one can't control, because we can control the kind of suffering that we might put on ourselves, then the other is, you know, it's just a matter of attitude, huh?
Yeah, it's a matter of attitude and awareness. You know, it's an awareness process. Mm-hmm. And the more you become aware of the layers of added tension that we do by the way we look at things and by the way we perceive, the awareness practice, it almost becomes funny at times when you really start to look at how we think, and you don't notice it because it's just routine. And what it does is the practice slows you down and allows you to see. And but yeah, it's awareness practice, and it's incredible. It's incredible.
Yeah,
it's really, really changed my life completely in many ways.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's really, you know, mindful. You know, it's really an embodiment project. Definitely, you know, the meditation practice. And as you were talking, I was thinking about how I'm not certain how Erica Huggins, former political prisoner who has taught meditation to those comrades and brothers and sisters and children even who are behind bars. And I'm not certain if she said that when we meditate, the soul talks to God. I'm not certain if she said that exactly.
That sounds right.
Yeah, she said something, this child said, and she shared it with me. But it was something like that, because when you're still, we can hear things that we can't hear necessarily when the noise that, or, you know, the chatter that is always around the surface of things. But when you meditate, you're going deeper. You're going underneath that.
That's right. And it's an incredible experience. I mean, if you've been to the Spirit Rock, to the POC, I mean, the retreats there are like 7 days, 7 days of silence.
Yeah.
And there's talking. There's some talking, as you know, in between. There's moments of talking. But most of the day is silence. And it's just, I mean, 7 days of silence, people think, 7 days, that's crazy. Like, how can you even do 1 day? And it's just the most profound experience to really sit within the silence, to eat within the silence, to walk within the silence, to just really sit within the silence. And it's a real deep discovery within yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, One Life Institute, they have the wonderful spirit silence and song, sort of healing meditation that occur quarterly, and there's one coming up, and I'm sure you know about One Life Institute. And then when I was my children were younger, we go out to the Quaker Center in Santa Cruz, and they would have these silent retreats. And a lot of times, people don't necessarily think that children can participate in these type of practices, and they do. My doctor actually takes her daughter to the desert, and they meditate.
Wow, fabulous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so wonderful. And, yeah, the children meditating, it's just, that's the time to start it. That's the place to begin it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a world where children begin when they're children to meditate. I really want to live in that world. It's wonderful.
Yeah, when my younger daughter, who is now 30, was in preschool in Berkeley, so she was 3 and 4, they would go to the Berkeley Arts Center. The teacher would take them there, and they would sit and find a piece of art and then hold their points.
Wow.
Yeah, and so she told me, like, one time I was, like, getting frustrated because of the traffic. She said, okay, Mommy, take a deep breath and hold your points. I'm like,
I
oh,
love
thank
it.
You.
I love it. I love it. I tell you, only in Berkeley.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how do people get tickets? Are you sold out? Sellbach is huge, but it can't sell out.
Yeah, it can sell out. We're not sold out. We'd
okay.
love for people to still buy tickets.
Excellent.
Tickets still available. You just can go to the box office or online. Go to Sellbach box office, and you will search for The Dream Never Dies, and there it will be. There's also a box office phone number that I should try to find while I'm talking.
642-9988. Is that that number?
That's the number. Thank you for
okay.
having that. Yes.
Oh, no problem.
So, yeah, that's the number that people can call, and they can get tickets for The Dream Never Dies for tomorrow night. That's right. So tickets
yeah.
are available. The show's at 7, and we want everyone to come down.
Okay, excellent. And again, that number is 510-642-9988. And you can buy online at tinyurl.com/AV6PBK4. Let me do it again. tinyurl.com/AV6PBK4. So there are two different ways you can get tickets. And I guess people can get tickets the evening of, right?
Yes, yes, yeah. There'll be tickets the evening of. So you could just come on down and get tickets anytime. That would be fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
We really will definitely still have some tickets available. And we'd love to see you just show up at the box office and come on down.
Okay. Yeah. So I have a couple more questions if you have just maybe 5
sure.
more.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were some things when I was reading your bio, and I'm like, I didn't have a chance to go online and research it. But when I read that you're a partner in Earthseed Consulting, LLC, I thought about Octavia Butler in particular with
mm-hmm.
regards to the Earthseed part. Because, you know, she's got
right.
that series. And
yep.
and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your work around connecting our, you know, sort of the same sustainability and connecting us, you know, with land, you know, African-American people with land and intentional communities and things like that. And I was wondering if you could tell us sort of if are there any communities like that you are participating in or anything that you are working on presently that we might be able to plug into?
That's a good question. I am currently not plugged into any of those communities, though I know that they are out there existing. I actually have a good friend, Ms. Dingweed Smith, who has a project called the Black Land Project.
Nice.
And, look up the Black Land Project. And she is doing some wonderful work on the planet and within the country. And she and I are kind of conspiring to work together on one of her projects. But she's back east, and she's all over the country just kind of interviewing. And she's been working on a big project, and part of it is video. But it has a lot to do with Black folks and land and place. And so she is a person that I just love her work and have been following a lot. And like I said, inspired by her and hopefully conspiring to work with her. Mm-hmm. But the vision of Earthseed basically is to work towards connecting the dots between folks of color and Black folks in particular, kind of inspiring and informing a better way to live on the planet and connecting folks of color with the sustainable movement and to share within diverse communities what's happening in the sustainable movement and making sure that we are at the table and that as this world, which has got to change, it has to move to a sustainable model or else, you know, it's just you know, we have a finite planet here, and we have finite resources, and we are acting as if they're infinite, and that's not going to last very long. So we have to change the way we live and the way we live on this planet. And in that, that movement is very strong, particularly in the Bay Area, it's very strong. And we want to make sure that folks of color are at the table and in those discussions, and making sure that we are upfront and centered in the green movement, in the movement that, that also is creating new ways to live, new ways to work, new ways to look at life, and that we have to be a major player in that. And so what Virtue does is we work to bring the communities of color into that dialogue and into that movement of front and center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about Shyam Shabaka in Richmond. You probably know him because he's doing a lot of great work around sustainable living, as well as working around trying to stop the environmental pollution of the various industries that are residents in that particular area, like Chevron and
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think they actually grow food too in this program.
Yeah, that's out there in Richmond. You've got Urban Tilt with Doria Robinson, who's doing an amazing job out in Richmond also bring about. She's growing just tons of food, and what happened in Richmond, you know, what was it, a few months ago when the Chevron just spewed its ugly fumes, really affected all the food that they were growing out there. And she's been on the forefront of that movement. Doria Robinson, she's an amazing, amazing woman at Urban Tilt. Her organization,
Nice, nice. And then there's the sister who is the former park ranger who has doing some work in Oakland, in West Oakland. I think they have a farm in West Oakland. Drawing a blank on her name. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No. I know who you're talking about.
I can't
think of her name right now either. I know exactly who you're talking about. Exactly. It'll come. there's a lot of good work happening here, particularly in the Bay Area. And the thing is that, you know, it needs to spread throughout the country. And it is. But we just happen to be a hot spot of the activity here. I mean, it's definitely, the Bay has a what they call the bubble, you know, of a sustainable bubble. Everybody's here, like you're preaching to the choir, and that's okay. That's okay. The choir still needs to be preached to and heard, but we do need to take our message out throughout the rest of the country and the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, with Earthseed having, you know, a place where, you know, we plug into your organization, and then we can find out where we are, like, okay, I'm here in Oakland, or I'm in Richmond, or I'm in San Francisco, or I'm in Southern California, and, you know, in the Valley, we can see where people are who are, you know, doing this type of sustainable or plugged into the sustainable movement, so we can connect with them, so we're not working alone. We can support one another.
Well, one of the things that adds to that is you mentioned that I am now a co-founder and CEO of Hub Oakland. And what Hub Oakland is, that's exactly what Hub Oakland is. It's a place where, it's a physical space that will be opening soon. The physical place, actually, well, that's the story I'll tell you. But it is a physical space where people will come who are all working in the sustainable movement and social justice and anything that you're passionate about that's changing the world to make a better world. What we do is we offer the space, the platform, for people to come and co-work and to co-learn and to co-grow and to grow together. There will be lots of programs that will take us to the next level, take people to the next level, whatever project you're working on or whatever idea it is that you are passionate about. It's a space where it's a co-working space, as well as with, like I said, lots and lots of programs that are going to really feed and grow the community. It's a community of change makers all coming together you know, sitting next to like-minded individual, and hopefully collaborating and taking whatever it is you're doing to the next level to expand and get you to where you want to go to. So that's what Hub Oakland is. We will incubate businesses. We will incubate social entrepreneurs, which are entrepreneurs who are working towards a just and sustainable world and making social impact. And so it is a space for social impact. It's a space for people to come and become a member and to, you know, we are basically prototyping the future.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Do you happen to know David Roach?
Yes, I do.
Oh, you know Mo Better Foods. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And it's film festival as well.
Yeah. It starts the same day as as The Dream Never Dies, but it continues through Sunday, and it's all over the place. He's even in San Leandro this year. He is really, he's in San Leandro, he's in Berkeley. Film Festival has screenings in Oakland and multiple places. I'm like, oh, that is so nice. And I think the kickoff was in South San Francisco. Oh,
wow.
and he's in Oakland, right. Chinatown. He's like, I think they have maybe six sites for the screenings. I mean, they're like, and they're not being duplicated. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they aren't. But it's just like really wonderful to see how in the Oakland International Film Festival that it, you know, it has really grown quite a bit in its 11th year, which is so wonderful. But David, he's the one that, you know, brought the Black Farmers to town and you know, the Black Farmers Market out in West Oakland. And first it was at McClymer's, where he was a teacher, economics teacher. And then, you know, right there at the bar, West Oakland Bar Station, you could get your fresh produce before you jump on the BART.
Yeah.
It's really neat.
Great work.
And then also, you know, sort of around, you know, the food justice issues, which I'm sure, you know, you look at with your organization, Earthseed.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, the food justice issues is huge. And what I love about Oakland is that it's an epicenter for convening that dialogue. And that is what definitely Earthseed, we're looking at that, and also with Ed Hub Oakland, really being involved and creating the space for, you know, films, discussion, all kinds of information and educational knowledge around what is happening in our food system, what the problems are, what are particularly the problems within the communities that are marginalized, the most marginalized communities, and not having real supermarkets, not having real food in the neighborhoods, and really looking at that conversation and awareness, again, creating awareness around the impact that food has. I mean, food is one thing that we all have in common, and it is, you know, people don't think a lot about it, but there's a huge injustice that has been going on in food and within our communities. And so we're shining a light on that and making sure that we can move and make changes around the food industry and what really needs to happen here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really wonderful. As I was trying to find the name of the sister who we can't think of her name.
I know.
I noticed that, I forgot too, that, you know, folks are growing food behind bars, you know, for themselves to eat as well as an economic venture, which is really great because the food, because tilling the earth and working with the earth is so healing, and that's also a meditation as well, because we're not necessarily connected to the earth the way we were once when there wasn't so much between us and the soil. You know, we have a lot of concrete.
That's right.
And it's hard to find those spaces. It's like it's hard to see the sky sometimes, depending on where you live. And also depending on the level of toxins in the environment. You know, one can't always see the blue.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
But if you have, you know, a balcony, you can grow food and you can put your hands in the soil. And it's so healing. I mean, I'm fortunate to have a backyard here in Oakland, and I've got, you know, a nice garden of collard greens and kale and tomatoes and onions.
Wonderful.
We even grew okra, and yeah, I've grown a lot of food here, and I just love it. It's really healing, and, you know, we have been disconnected from the earth with this concrete world and our concrete jungle, as they say, that we live in, and it's really about, you know, bringing that back into your lives, really, and particularly with the children. It's so important that the children understand how food grows and where it grows, and that it doesn't grow in the grocery store, and that it actually comes from the earth, and allowing them to put their hands in the earth. I know with my godchildren who live in L.A., whenever I give them a gift, it's always a plant. It's always something. I don't buy toys. I don't buy things like that. I give them something that gets them to the earth, and they grow something. And so it's really, I think, vital that we bring our children back to the earth and bring ourselves back to it, because it makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just finding all these great gardens as I look for the sister, Jason Harvey. He's an African-American born and raised in East Oakland who started the Oakland Food Connection, which I'm sure you know.
Yeah,
about.
Yeah, I know.
So I was wondering, maybe I could have you back on closer to Mother Earth Day.
Oh, I'd love that. I would love that. That would be great. I'm actually on a panel at Spirit Rock. Spirit Rock Meditation Center is doing a Earth Day. I don't know the date. I should know that. They're doing Earth Day coming up, and I will be actually on a panel there that day. But, yeah, I'd love to. Oh, Earth Day celebration. I'm looking at my calendar right now. It is on Friday, April the 19th.
Okay.
Friday, April 19th, yeah, at Spirit Rock Meditation Center.
Yeah, because I was thinking the 20th, because I think Earth Day is normally somewhere like the 20th or something like that. Okay, nice.
Right.
Excellent.
Exactly.
Yeah. So how can people, you know, stay in touch and find out about all these great programs like the Hub and Earthseed and all that? Do you have a website or something you give us?
I do. What I'd like to talk about, too, is that Hub Oakland, like I was saying, is we've just opened up a pop-up in downtown Oakland, a pop-up means we're popping up out of a space that is located in downtown Oakland at 14th and Broadway, right at Frank Abdala Plaza.
Okay.
And we're there at 1423 Broadway right now, and it's just a temporary location. Our real location is at 2323 Broadway, which is an incredible 16,000 square foot space that we're building out that will be open in October of this year. But in the meantime, what we're doing is we're starting on Monday, April 8th, a big Kickstarter campaign. And so you can actually go to, if you go to Kickstarter.com and look up Hub Oakland, you will find out a lot about us there, and really encourage you also to join our Kickstarter campaign. It opens, like I said, Monday the 8th. And our website, we have a temporary website right now that will go live starting on the 8th again, which is www.huboakland.net. So we're huboakland.net, and that's H-U-B, hub, H-U-B-O-A-A-K-L-A-N-D, huboakland.net. And that's where that information is. And for the information regarding the show tomorrow night, it's eastbaymeditation.org. That's eastbaymeditation.org. And that's the website for finding out about tomorrow night.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also for the programs that are happening this evening and afterwards.
Yes.
Because it's a great community. Great community.
That's right.
Yeah. And we're going to be listening to these activists and scholars talk about the beloved community. That's right. Here in our backyards, in our neighborhoods, that people might not know about.
That's right.
Yeah, so it's definitely a way to get connected as well. Get fed in a lot of different kind of ways, you know, spiritually, emotionally, intellectually. It's going to be a great evening, and thank you so much for pulling this program together with all your friends. Well, I got to hang with you. You know.
I'm blessed. So, yeah, and thank you so much for having me on your show. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to meeting you in person. I hope you come into the show tomorrow night.
Yes. There were a lot of things happening, but it's like, no, this one here, this is the one. Wherever Alice Walker is, that's where I am too.
Awesome. Well, we'll make sure that we'll see you backstage. We'll make sure you have a backstage pass. We absolutely need to meet you.
Thank you so much. Wow. Yeah. That's so exciting. Yeah, it was really funny. And I'm going to let you go because, you know, tomorrow's the day. But I went to, you know, how there would be the people's history readings. And Alice Walker's former professor, who wrote the People's History of the United States, among other things, he had a series. And I'm drawing a blank on his name. Oh, my goodness. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, of course.
And what's his name?
Of course. It's
too early.
I'm even looking at him right now in my mind.
Yeah, and so at that particular reading, I don't remember who she, because the people will read, they will read the narratives. Howard Zinn, yes. May his soul rest in peace and be lifted up with the
hand. Yes.
Wonderful
hand.
Lovely. I went backstage, and she, her book, We Are the Ones, we've been waiting for, you know, based on the June Jordan poem, had just come out. And Alice Walker was backstage, and I was with a Marina Drummer and my friend Robert King, and we were backstage, and I saw Alice Walker walking with her bag, and she said, "Hi, have you got my book yet?" I said, "No," because she had spoken recently at a fundraiser for the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, and one of my good friends had tea with her when she was released from prison after over 20 years behind bars. And so she gave me the person who was with her, she took a book out the bag. It was back when the book was in hardback, now it's in paperback. And she took it out the bag and she signed it. I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be my textbook for next semester. And so I actually use it in my class. But I bring up the book because it's such a wonderful book. It's small, you can put it in your purse. And each chapter, after you read the story, there's a meditation. It's so wonderful. I mean, for people that don't quite know how to meditate and just want to ease into it, I highly recommend that book because she gives these wonderful stories. She talks about her life, and these talks are sometimes there might have been a commencement address, or it might be related to some particular topic or something she was working through. And then she gives a really short meditation, like, you know, share an orange with a child. And notice how they peel it, and you know, something, smell it. You know, really simple but quite profound tasks to help us deepen the experience. Just wonderful. So anyway.
she's just amazing. She's just amazing. And one other thing that I realized that I didn't talk about is the music. I just want to present the music that is happening tomorrow night as well. So we've got Ricky Byers-Beckwith, who is the musical director at Agape in Los Angeles, and also Michael Beckwith's wife. She will be performing, I don't know if you've not heard Ricky, Lord have mercy. She's amazing, amazing, amazing piano and voice and writer, songwriter, and musical director. She's incredible. So she'll be performing, and they're both coming up from L.A. And then we have locally Raz Kennedy, who is from the Bay Area, well, lives in the Bay Area, and has been here for, you know, many decades doing music. He sang with Bobby McFerrin, and he's a vocal coach for many of the vocalists who are out there in the Bay Area now. He's worked with just hundreds and hundreds of people producing records and doing his own thing. And he and his partner, Pollyanna Bush, will be performing also. And so it's going to be quite a night with music and discussion. So I just want to.
And you are moderating.
And I'm moderating, exactly. I also sent you, I don't know if you were able to pull it up, but I did send you a track from Raz and Pollyanna.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't even look.
I did.
Well, I'll have to play it on Friday and tell people how great Thursday was.
Okay. No worries.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, so it's going to be a full night. It's going to be a full night.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah. Well, and since I don't have that, I was actually looking to see what might be a great sort of closing to this discussion and opening to this wonderful The Dream Never Dies conversation that has already started, of course. I mean, it started as soon as Martin King stepped onto to the planet and opened his mouth and we were able to participate or just listen to his thoughts and ideas and his ideals, which, you know, he paid with his life. You know, that's like the ultimate ultimate gift to the community is when you dedicate your life to the community. And when he, you know, gave his speech, you know, The Mountaintop, which is the title of a play currently at Theater Works, and tomorrow they're going to be having Dr. Claiborne Carson speaking about Martin King. So there's just all this great stuff happening, you know, all this great
energy
around.
Wow, I didn't
even
hear about that. Great.
Yeah, so that's really wonderful. So I thought I might play the Soweto Gospel Choir's Grace, because I thought that would be really nice.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. So thank you once again so much, and I look forward to the program tomorrow. It's going to be simply fantastic. I mean, I don't know. I can't even imagine how great it's going to be. I know it's going to be fabulous, but I won't know for sure until I'm there. in
the
place.
It will be. It will.
Of course.
Be wonderful. Of course.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I really look forward to seeing you and meeting you tomorrow.
Okay. Well, you take good care and you know, good luck on the final, you know, tying of ropes and not ropes, but ribbons and, you know, and you know, final preparations that I'm sure go to this such a big production.
Yeah. Thank you, Wanda. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Going to be great. All right.
Yeah.
I'll see
we
you
take
tomorrow.
Good care, and I'm looking forward to continued conversations.
Absolutely.
All
okay.
Right.
Be well.
Bye-bye. Peace and blessings. Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So we were speaking to Conda Mason, and I want to mention to folks again that HubOakland.net is launched officially on April 8th, and you should visit it, and you can stop by the space at 1423 Broadway, which is not the permanent space for Hub Oakland, which they're building. It's going to be opening in October, she said, but you can pop through and see what's going on, a place to connect and with like-minded and like-spirited folks. So here is the Soweto Gospel Choir. Actually, I was going to play If the Rain Comes because of thinking about Sweet Baby and lifting her face to the sky and her husband being the rain. I thought, oh, that's so beautiful. So I think I'm going to play both, actually. I think I'm going to start with Grace and then end with If the Rain Comes First by Somi.
Thank you.
Soway to Gospel Choir. And so don't forget to go to those Kickstarter campaigns for Javelin Richards and for Conda Mason, the Hub Oakland Project, as well as the Nappy Hair Love Stories for Javelin Richards. And we're going to close, as I mentioned before, with If the Rain Comes First, and that is So Me. Looking forward to having you tune in again for another edition of Wanda's Picks, which is airing on Friday, April 8th, 8 o'clock a.m. Pacific Time. We're going to open with a conversation, a reprise of the conversation with Jesse about his book, Sugar Re-Rising. So that's going to really be fun. And we have a lot of surprises in store for our Friday program. So here is If the Rain Comes First.